Okay, so we're here today with Sisters of Resistance, and we're going to sort of talk about how their feminist praxis, particularly their blog, contributes to our thinking about feminist strategies in a contemporary period. So if you'd like to introduce yourselves, that would be great.
I'm Angela Martinez-D. You can also call me Aldea.
I'm Sophia Mason, and I am a final year PhD student looking at women's testimonial literature in Latin America. And yeah, my mum was a feminist, so yeah.
Okay, so we started, maybe if you could start by talking a little bit about what brought you to feminism and how it sort of has impacted you and got you to where you are now.
I think I was one of those children, I've heard that there's other girls like this growing up who are like innately feminist. So if boys told me I couldn't play football or whatever, I would apparently fight back and get very angry and tell all the adults and stuff like that. So as a child, I noticed that boys were allowed to do things I wasn't supposed to do, and that annoyed me. So I would say, I would genuinely say it's innate. But then calling myself a feminist and my engagement with feminist literature and the women's movement came at university when I had a lecturer who was a feminist and who sort of enabled me to begin to analyse films and cultural products and history and etc. from a feminist perspective. So I would say it went from an innate a childhood feeling to a sort of I developed it at university.
As for me, I feel like I had a really strong feminist role model in my mom, who when dealing with my dad's infidelity, just decided to leave him, and she went back to school and decided that she was gonna find a way to financially support me and her without having to rely on a male figure in our lives. And so that was my indirect introduction, I would say. And then a bit later on, I started to develop an understanding of identity politics through my involvement with the Filipino American Spoken Word Collective. And there were a few women in that organization who I really built with, I would say, about a feminist understanding of the world. And we wrote a lot of work together, we wrote poems together and performed together. And that was kind of where I think I first found that solidarity. And then coming to university was very eye-opening. I started to read, you know, Black feminist studies, queer feminist studies, and really start to have some more language to talk about the things that I'd seen. And then moving into the Sisters of Resistance headquarters was the icing on the cake, really. It's given me, a whole lot of perspective about what radical feminism could look like, as well as entrance into the history by way of our massive library. So, yeah.
You both talk about voice. Like you voicing as a kid, as a child, going, no, they say no, I'm going to do it. Or you like writing poetry and finding language.
Mm-hmm.
What role does you think voice, speaking, has in feminism?
We were talking about this recently the other day. We were saying that patriarchy it becomes invisible. Like, it doesn't become invisible if you're a woman and your boyfriend is beating you up. And then in a lot of ways, patriarchy is patently visible, but it tries to invisibilise itself by naturalising female oppression, by saying that women are inferior, are born that way, or it's because of their biology, or whatever. In lots of different ways, patriarchy is normalised, and our everyday lived experiences of oppression as women are invisibilised. That's the best way of saying it. So patriarchy is visible, but our oppression is invisibilised.
Yeah,
so where the voice comes into it is that if a system of oppression is invisibilized, speaking out against that system of oppression is in its very nature a form of resistance, just before you've even organized or anything else, as soon as you've just spoken out. So every single time a woman stands up and says, I was sexually harassed or my boyfriend beating me or whatever, you know, it can be on that personal level. It doesn't even have to be a profound articulation of, you know, of political theory of feminism. Whenever you speak out against patriarchy, you are resisting patriarchy. So that's where I would say the voice comes in.
No, definitely. And another thing that has come up in our conversations lately is the idea of that naming is powerful. And when you can name what's happening to you, it gives you more of a grasp on what it is and what you can do about it. And there's a sense of agency in being able to name what is going on.
So a specific example of that would be gaslighting. So gaslighting is a word that comes from apparently a film in which the man turned all the gas lights down so that they flickered, and then when his wife said, "Oh, the gas light's down," he said, no, you're just going mad. And that was a film. And basically gaslighting is when men, whenever, if you're a woman, if a man has ever told you you're mad, he was gaslighting. Like whenever you're having an argument and you get angry and you're told that you were imagining it or that you're overreacting, that's another common one, that you love drama, that you're dramatizing it, any of those kinds of, you're being crazy, acting crazy. And I know I get called that every time I have an argument with any of my ex-boyfriends. Whenever we argued, they would do that. That's gaslighting. And so if you get told you're mad and you don't know what gaslighting is, you believe it. You think to yourself, I'm a bit mad, I'm overreacting. You totally believe it. And that's when you're entering into an abusive relationship. Once you can name gaslighting, once you know what it is, you can say, no, he's gaslighting me. Like, he is being abusive to me. And then you can leave that relationship. So that's an example of how naming and, like, identifying these... Because they have, the same way we need to have strategies of resistance, they have strategies of oppression. Like, we are oppressed as women in a variety of different ways, but they actually have, abusive men, for example, have strategies that they employ in order to abuse us, in order to maintain us in a particular psychological place so that we accept their abuse. When you start to name those, their strategies, you can develop your own counter strategies which can enable you to survive and overcome that oppression.
Like naming, like developing a language, developing a feminist language.
Yeah.
But as part of that, because we've had this discussion before, right, but as part of this, once you start naming and once you start then recognising what's been invisibilised in your everyday life, you start to see everywhere, right? You start to see everywhere.
Yeah.
And then there's a lot, and then what happens is you also start to reconsider and think back of things that have happened in your own life.
Yeah.
And connect with them and understand them and emotionally connect with them in different ways. And a lot of times that brings up anger and rage. But something that I struggle with and that we've been involved with lots of discussions about is what is the role of anger and rage in a feminist practice, and how, if there is a rightful role for these emotions, how do we express them in a way that doesn't re-articulate patriarchy? Like how? What do we do? I don't know, what are your ideas about ways or
something? I think the first point is to assert that we have every right to be angry. That after, this is where I begin from. I begin from, you know, if you can, calmly asserting that women that do become angry have every single right. That after centuries of abuse, of sexual abuse, of dehumanization, of like forced domestication, of being, you know, practically enslaved, you know, and I don't think that's an exaggeration. We didn't have personhood, we weren't allowed to own property. We're talking about extreme oppression that's gone on for hundreds and hundreds of years. Mm. That creates anger, and that's a legitimate... So the first thing to do is to assert that it is a legitimate anger, that if women are angry, if feminists are angry, it is for good reason that they are angry. That's where I begin from. So acknowledging that anger and asserting it and like drawing historical, you know, justifications for why the anger should exist. But then secondly, I would say channeling it. So channeling it can mean, anger is quite powerful, you know, you get a lot of energy from anger, but you don't want it to eat away at you as a feminist so that you can't engage and you can't practice your feminism. So I would say channeling it can be writing it down. Right. So the blog for me, you know, the first thing that we wrote on the blog was a letter to male activists. And that's an extremely angry piece of writing. That came from anger. That came from us trying to assert that we deserved a bit of respect and that, you know, just trying to have a discussion about gender, a man saying, I'm a feminist, and just shouting us that he was a feminist and being really, 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 really abusive, and then just, you know, and it came from a massive argument, it came from a place of anger. And we wrote it down. We wrote, to men who think that they're feminists, you know, how dare you tell us that we do not have a right to articulate our own experiences of oppression? Do you know what I mean? So channel it. So that's basically what the blog began from, channeling anger. So write it down is what I would say about anger. Talk to other women about it. Don't bother talking to men because they're not going to understand. Talk to other women about that anger because they will have shared experiences. So channel it, share it. Write it down, try to work through it, and just try to channel it into action ultimately. Like, try to channel it into organisation and action. That's what I would say.
Yeah, I fully agree. I feel like anger is your fuel, as the fuel for the fire, you know? And without it, it's like you're just wandering around in the sea of ignorance. If you're not angry, it feels like you're ignorant. I don't know if I'm expressing that correctly.
That's
like,
what they say. They say if you're not pissed off, you're not paying attention.
Yeah,
that's what they say.
So, so the anger is yeah, as Sophia said, it's completely natural. It's a natural response to the conditions that you're experiencing and the women around you are experiencing. What's happening to you and your people, you know? So. Yes, it's very natural, and it's useful. But number one is to not let it hit your body, not let it, you know, attack you first. Turn it outwards, and find ways to structure it, maybe, and not in the sense of confining structures, but ways that you can build something with that anger.
Yeah, a lot of other contributions in this discussion have talked about the importance of all women's safe spaces, creating safety.
Definitely.
But also the whole thing that I think you mentioned, Sophia, about this is centuries, right? This is centuries of our lines of women, our ancestors, our forebearers, right, who have suffered all these exclusions and silencing. And there's, in liberation psychology, I've been reading about it recently, there's this idea of the soul wound, that we carry collectively soul wounds that come from all these histories, but also in our present. So the role of healing and the psychological is a big part of a feminist practice. Mm-hmm. And it'd be really fascinating to hear about what you think about the role of healing and the psychological in our transformation, in our feminist transformation.
And so the book that I would recommend on this subject is a text written by a feminist psychologist. She's called Judith Herman, and it's called From Trauma to Recovery. I always forget that title, but something about the links between domestic abuse and sort of state terror. So she looks at soldiers suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, and she argues that women who are victims of domestic violence are suffering. They're under a state of siege and captivity in similar ways, but they suffer what she calls a complex form of post-traumatic stress disorder. Mm-hmm. So first of all, the first words of the book are, this book wouldn't exist without the women's movement, and she talks about how in the 1960s women created speak outs. So they had public speak outs on university campuses where women would have a little stage and a mic, and women would testify to being raped. And it was the women's movement, she argues, who visibilised incest, rape, domestic violence. Before that, patriarchy was doing a quite good job, mm-hmm. in the 1940s, 50s, of completely denying that anything like that ever happened. You know, there was just this happy little nuclear patriarchal family, and any woman who said that it wasn't happy was lying. But the feminist movement totally destroyed that image and said, no, this whole system is riven with abuse, with serious abuse. So they created these spaces. So she's arguing that abuse creates the exact same psychological trauma that we've only really ever applied to men, soldiers, or people who have undergone public trauma, so an earthquake or something. She's arguing, no, there are continuities here, and that for women. So the definition of trauma had always been an experience outside the realm of normality, because trauma is something that comes at you that you can't explain, that challenges your understanding of yourself and your place in the world. And so the definition from the American Psychiatric Association was an experience outside the realm of normality. Now, Judith Herman argues, for women, violence and traumatic violence is not an unusual experience. It's part of the everyday for us. It's such a common experience. That definition doesn't fit. So she expands the definition of trauma, first of all, to incorporate female victims of domestic violence. She then argues, as I said, the title is Trauma to Recovery, so she you know, really creates this equilibrium between discussing and identifying the trauma and then moving on to recovery. And the first thing she says is that you have to establish safety. She says a lot of people overlook that and they just want to get to the working through and the talking cure. She says, no, people really have to appreciate how safe this space needs to be and how much trust needs to be established before we can start to work through our trauma. Having really established that sense of safety, then you can go to work through it. And the way that you work, so come to a question about how you work through it psychologically. Again, I've already said it, it's about writing it down or working it through. So it's about constructing a narrative, whether that be through poetry, as Angela said, through a blog post, as we've done, or through sitting around with your girls and talking about how he made you feel. This is constructing a narrative about your experience, and it has to be one, she says, that, and a lot of people that write about trauma and therapeutically working through trauma say that it has to be quite a detailed, emotional narrative, to be quite detached and to not really engage with the feelings and your response to that trauma won't necessarily be working it through. Although, you know, people find different ways, because one of the traumatized narratives I look at, she relies very much on human rights discourse. I think people find different ways, but the point in, let me just try and get to the point, the point in constructing the narrative is that you're able to integrate the traumatic experience into your understanding of yourself and the world without the shame and guilt that comes with being abused and being traumatized. So rather than blaming yourself, you begin to understand why it happened to you, the fact that it wasn't your fault. You begin to sort of move on from that traumatic experience by articulating it and coming to terms with it, really, because a traumatic event is one that your brain can't process, that you can't come to terms with. So you construct a narrative that reintegrates that traumatic experience into your life narrative, and then from there you can move on. So that's what I would say about trauma and recovery.
Very much so. I think the idea of safe spaces is something that I wanted to touch on, because it's just something that I personally experienced in artistic spaces when I was working with that arts collective. One of the primary functions of the collective was to create safe space for people of color, for voices that are otherwise marginalized. And at that time it wasn't women-centric, but it was more acknowledging that as people of color we've been pushed out of the center and our voices have been invalidated, and so that within the space that we created, our stories were valued and were very, very relevant, and that they were points of connection that we could embrace each other's experiences and commonalities in that safe place, and that was a very I want to say moving, really. It was a moving experience of healing, of collective healing, that kind of shocked me into realizing that the healing process could be engaged upon, that there was something that needed to be healed. Number one, is that it forced me to acknowledge that I was wounded, that I was carrying around a lot of, you know, whatever from my life, past lives, I don't know. But when I started to see how much so many of us were hurt, and that coming together and sharing our stories in this way had a profound physical, psychological effect, like after the event, after the show, there would be a lightness in the air that was unlike anything I'd felt before. So the priority of creating a safe space is, whether that's in your home or, you know, in with the goal of eventually carrying it around with you wherever you go, the goal of having that safe space with you is, I think, it's primary.
Even when you talk about that it wasn't originally gender, like just women, and then it was also about particular communities of colour, it makes me think, like, because obviously we want female unity and solidarity, right? But sometimes, like, so I'll be in this space in the academy, and I come from a particular background, and it's not necessarily the same as perhaps some of my colleagues, and there aren't that many women who are mothers. It's true, right? But sometimes, and there is the solidarity of being a mother in a very patriarchal space and what that means and what's excluded and what's silenced, but also if you're sort of quite an upper middle class white mother in a 2.2 family with all professional things, there is a different experience from being a mixed race, mixed class, single mother.
Yeah.
And that, so I sort of think, how do we, like, we want to create solidarity with all women, but also take into these questions of, or do we, I don't know, class, race, class and race, actually, where do they come into it? Or
the testimonial literature that I look at for my PhD is authored by Indigenous, peasant, I don't really like that word because it's got negative connotations, campesino, like, women. And they pretty conclusively assert that they do not have anything in common with North American women, middle class, upper class North American women. And, like, I don't think it's going to be easy, and it might not even be productive to try and work with women who are, have vested interest in the status quo, who have made that almost decision or whatever, or been born into that class. I just don't think, on the one hand, I see the way their husbands treat them and the way that men treat them, and I see that there is ground for solidarity because they are women and they do get treated not as well as men just because they're women. Like, the most upper class women still do not get, in fact upper class culture, if anything, I've noticed the gender roles are more pronounced, and the women have even stricter guidelines over their comportment than working class women do and always have done, because working class women have always had to work and do everything, whereas upper class women have been even more protected. It's almost like femininity is almost even more protected, whereas working class women, we've never really been able to be that feminine because we've always had to work and be covered in soot or whatever. Do you know what I mean? We've been working class. It's not feminine. Whereas upper class women, the whole femininity thing, I think, is a massive part of their identity. And so, therefore, they do stand to gain from a feminist revolution. They do stand to be liberated. However, because they're economically, they're so vested in this system. So this is where you see intersections now of class, I'm focusing on class and gender, that I can't see them being overcome. The race thing for me is a massive part of the way I look at feminism. So again, I'm also very interested in black feminism. And for me, I focus, and I think we said earlier about focusing on gender and race. The reason why I do that is because I got brought up around class-based revolutionaries, so socialists, who focus on class. And I feel like in the left in this country, among people on the left in this country, trade unionists, socialists, the student movement, the anti-war movement, whoever is left-wing in this country, I find that they simply do not acknowledge gender or race at all. They just don't bother. And, like, I was reading a brilliant academic recently, leftist academic, and he just didn't mention race. You will pick up a book and it will not mention race or gender. It'll be a brilliant expose of capitalism and this system, and it will not mention race or gender. So I almost am focusing on it. I'm focusing on those two issues because I feel, because they're close to home, but B, because I feel like they are not addressed sufficiently, and so I almost feel like we have to focus on them. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I agree completely, you know, that they get neglected and that the discourse gets broken up into which oppression are we going to talk about today, not that the ways that oppression affects us in intersecting ways. I feel that even with all the feminist scholarship that has been done in those areas and intersectionality and stuff, that it's still not brought to the fore.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been, I don't know, 30, 40 years. Maybe I'm overstating, but Bell Hooks wrote Ain't I a Woman in 1981, and so that's going on 30 years now. And for feminists who claim that they are fully feminist and yet who aren't educating themselves on the different types of feminism, I feel like that's neglectful on their part. And what I was going to say earlier is, I don't know exactly how this would come about, but I feel like it's the responsibility of feminists with privilege to establish solidarity with feminists who don't have that kind of privilege. It's not the responsibility of of people who are not privileged to reach up and say, please be solidarity, be in solidarity with us. I don't think that that's their responsibility. I think that folks who have privilege need to, number one, recognize their privilege and use it to further the cause and use it to establish solidarity and not to use it just for themselves. And then folks who are
and
doing
not
to
silence, because when they're silent, particularly, silence, hang on, this is, we're a totally different experience. Even though you're and I'm all bloody hell, we can't say, oh yeah, we're
yeah, exactly.
Seriously, and to try to say that theirs is the only type of feminism or the right type of feminism. That's and because of their privilege, they get the spotlight. So I think that. It's going to be that solidarity is going to be much more possible among folks who have similar backgrounds, number one. But that, if anything, those with privilege need to recognize it and pull back, step back, and learn how to let others lead.
And listen to others as well. Like, with the internet, you know, there's, for white people who, for white feminists who do want to learn, because the thing about white people is we're brought up not to see our privilege. So white is the normative term, no? It's the unmarked term. So what I mean by that is, if I say to you, imagine someone walking into a bar, you will probably not imagine like a disabled black woman. You'll probably imagine a white man, because that's the unmarked term. So that means that this system has constructed white men as if they are humans, and the rest of us are like sort of not quite normal or whatever.
Upper class as well.
And upper class. And so if you want to unlearn that, if as a feminist or radical person, you have a genuine commitment to unlearning that. With internet, like, I have learned a lot from this blog called People of Colour Organise, and they've got several different articles addressed to white people. 10 conversations I'm sick of having with white people. 5 things white activists should never say. And there's one from black feminists to white feminists. And it says, it says don't try and get one person of colour in your group to try and be like, oh, look, we've got a person of colour in our group, and things like that. And it, yeah, and it, but they're really, really, it's this thing about anger, I think, because I think you can tell these are people of colour who've had to have these conversations over and over and over and over again, and it is frustrating. And I think as a white person, I think it's about learning to listen to the experiences of other people who go through forms of oppression that you don't go through. So white feminists, I think, need to read black feminists, listen to black feminists. I will say, most of the books authored by white feminists that I've read in the last, like, that have come out in the last 10 years do acknowledge, like, they almost over-apologetic, not over-apologetic, you can't be over-apologetic about the, but what they do is they, you know, explicitly say feminism started amongst these middle-class white women, Betty Friedan and the like, and it wasn't acknowledging class, race. But what I'm trying to say is, I believe that within feminism, people like bell hooks, Angela Davis, and all of the women writing around issues of, so feminists, working class feminists, lesbian feminists, black feminists, I think they've done really, really well at visibilising amongst feminism. Like, I don't think anyone really mentions feminism now without saying, it's so many things, the movement is so varied, women are so different. Mm. So I don't think most people, I don't think, maybe it's because of the types of feminism I look at, it's automatically going to be like this, but I personally am not that aware, and again, it could be because of my privileges, I'm not acknowledging it, I'm not realising it, but I feel like within feminism, more than, for example, within mainstream society,
sure,
you are getting an acknowledgement of different people's experiences. I think it was a lot worse 30, 40 years ago when, like you say, it was just these middle-class white women. I think now there are socialist feminists, there are black feminists, there are lesbian feminists, and I think people are, you know, most people I know are talking about cis privilege, like transgender, like most feminists I know are constantly engaging with a wide variety of different types of feminism. So I think we've come a long way as a women's movement. Like, I think it is better. Like I said, compared to the left, compared to like the you know, non-feminist left, like just the left, like I said, the anti-war movement, all of these people, you go to their stuff, and I don't see them consistently acknowledging race, gender, mm-hmm. transgender, but I don't see them consistently reaching out to all in the way that I think the women's movement does. Again, it could be my own bias, but I do think that we've come a long way. And obviously, we've still got a million miles to go because of the fact that white women, however feminist they are, do have a type of privilege that they're going to have to actively try to unlearn. And because of the fact that straight women and middle class women are going to be privileged in all these different kinds of ways. And so it is going to take a real dedication And I think it comes with a movement as well. I think like all of this stuff is good in theory, but in practice is when you organise with other people and you start to actually do things that you learn as well.
But do you think that this should then the most important strategic thing is to create our own feminist movements, or to try and make those movements on the left or those broader movements actually engage with this all?
I think it depends how much energy and strength you've got. Like, if you've got the energy and strength to try to make those other spaces acknowledge female, the need for female equality and stuff like that, if you've got the psychological, physical strength to do that, then you should. But if, like most of us, you're healing and patriarchy has traumatised you, etc., then you need those feminist spaces. Maybe both. Maybe make sure you've got those safe feminist women-only spaces, so that from there you can go out and try to politicise those other spaces and make sure those other spaces are aware of feminist issues.
Yeah, it's like politics, feminist politics, or politics, and bringing this interview is, you know, not just about winning an argument. It's an emotional, physical, you know, embodied thing about on all these levels of how we change the way we even occupy space. You know what I mean? What we do in a space and the roles people play and the assumptions about language and who does what and who can participate and who can't. And there's a real depth, I think, that often is missed in terms of when people think about what politics is and what our anti-patriarchal politics would look like.
Mm-hmm. I think part of that strategy, same strategy as well, using this kind of terminology, is like knowing when to advance and when to retreat. Like sometimes you are prepared for the kinds of emotional labor that it takes to convince a man that what he's doing is patriarchal, or to convince a group that what they've done is silence you or whatever. It's really stressful and it takes a lot out of you, so you have to know that after that, pull back, you know, don't go into those spaces again for a while if you can help it. Take good care of yourself, you know, prioritize your self-care. You know, you need to know, you know, when it's too much and when you need to kind of put your foot down and say, I'm not going to deal with this right now, I'm not going to do that for you today.
Pick your battles, basically.
Yeah.
I think pick your battles, definitely. Like, some men will come along, like I've got, I mean, several men, really, if I think about it, in my life, who, because they're close friends, I have put that emotional labour in that Angela's talking about, and it's reaped strong rewards.
Mm-hmm.
I've probably come across as like a bitter, angry feminist, but the reality is I've got close male friends who are now feminists because of me, and they're like a big part of my life. And they go back to all their, whenever their male friends say the types of misogynistic things that men in groups often say, they will be challenged by my friend who's become a feminist, and they know now that they can't say certain things about girls in front of him, because he will just say like, oh, that's like saying, you know, he'll go off on them. And so I think if you pick your battles carefully, and if it's somebody who's intelligent, what I find, I was talking to someone about this on Twitter the other day, they were asking me for advice for how to convince their dad about the need for feminism and stuff like that. I sent her loads of resources. There's loads of stuff online, like men against rape, and there's a big male feminist organisation that I sent her links to. But what I said to her was that I've had the most success with men that experience some kind of oppression themselves, and that with privileged white, I've never even attempted with a privileged white man. I've never even attempted, because it would just be lost cause. I've got socialists to acknowledge it, I've got black men to acknowledge it, I've got, you know, hippie, vegan-y kind of men to acknowledge it, but sort of privileged white upper middle class men, I don't even bother, because I don't know where you would begin. So pick your battles, you know, don't go up to a massive Tory who's got a vested interest in patriarchy and capitalism and everything and try to convince him with all your might, because you're just wasting valuable energy. But if it's someone in your circle, if it's someone you have got some kind of relationship with, if it's someone who's already critical, right, because feminism is another critical way of analysing a form of oppression, if they're already analysing forms of oppression in their life, enable them to see patriarchy as well, then definitely do take that on. So I think we both spend a lot of time engaging with men and with male spaces and stuff like that, male spaces in non-feminist spaces, like patriarchal spaces. We do spend a lot of energy on that, but like Angela says, it can be really, really depressing, and you can feel like you're not getting anywhere. So that's when you then need to go and be around women and other feminist women and talk to them.
For that collective wisdom.
Yeah,
but you're a bit lost on your own, can't you? Because you can get that judgment, you can lose that. So that,
and for that shared experience, like I can literally, any woman of my friends or in the family, I can literally start talking about men, and they'll go, oh, well, they're like that, aren't they? And the other day I said to him, he said this, and like, I don't know any woman who's like, oh, really? Because I've literally never had an experience of sexism with my boyfriend, does whatever I say. Like, I don't know any other confidence. So we've all got these experiences, we have, and so just sharing them, I think helps.
Acknowledging that they're true, yeah.
And that it's not you, like you're not mad, you're not crazy, it's not your fault, this is the system of oppression we're dealing mm-hmm. with.
You know? And then you start to see the patterns in it and you're like, ah, so this is how it's working.
So how does the blog fit in then in terms of voice and healing and mm-hmm. safe space?
And community, yeah. All those things, definitely. I think it was one of the ways that we could bring all of those aspects together, really, is like our voice plus the other voices of the people who are responding, who are reading. And it is a safe space. We declared that in the beginning when we started getting attacked by non-feminist patriarchal men on the blog. We were like, no, we're just not going to admit your comment. This is not a space for this kind of
stuff.
What
we would do, we would write a reply. So we wouldn't publish the original comment, but we would reply to it. So we'd be like, due to the fact we are creating a safe space, we will not be replying to comments regarding the dun-dun-dun. We'd like put in quotation marks maybe some of the horrible stuff they said. But then we would undermine it.
Yep.
So we'd argue against it, we would engage with it if we had the energy, but we would definitely not be publishing. This is not a space for their voices. They have the whole world.
Mm-hmm.
They have the whole world. They're not going to have our blog as well.
So we created a safe space electronically. In terms of healing, like sometimes it is immediate healing method, like an immediate response to something that's happening at the time. Let's write about this now, and it helps with the healing process for that night, for example.
So like we find out our boyfriends are cheating on us and we're like, right, let's do one on cheating men, and we do a whole series on how to tell if your man's cheating on you.
Yeah.
And we just share all of this information, all this stuff we've analysed.
Yeah.
And then what happens is when you've written that stuff out and you've written down in quotation marks, oh, I've just been really busy, or I've been with my family, or my phone's broken, or whatever it is. The next time a guy says that to you, you're thinking, oh my God, that's on my blog.
So
the strategies, once you've identified their strategies, they don't work anymore because like, I know what you're doing. Like,
yeah.
I know this is a strategy. Like,
it comes across really clearly. Oh, and then we will also ask our female friends for additional comments.
We work with other women. It's not just us. We work with other women. Like, several of the articles have been in close conjunction with like a wider group of women that are involved in this project.
So that's bringing those voices together.
And all those experiences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That whole method of collectively sharing knowledge and bringing together is a feminist method.
Yeah.
Right? It's an anti-patriarchal. It's not merely about one ego saying, I'm a superstar who's going to tell you the truth. It's, right, hang on, how can we come together?
Yeah.
So the method through which we produce these voices.
Yeah. Inviting lots of experience, lots of female experiences of whatever it is that is concerning us at the time, and acknowledging that what's on our minds is worth being discussed, worth having an article written about it, that it shouldn't just be pushed out, and that we shouldn't just get on with it, that we have to deal with these things that are coming up for us, and that we can deal with them in a productive way.
But what's noticeable as well, like when we sort of talked about this originally, is that it's really diverse, the blog. So it's got like music and stuff about history, it's got like checklists and like stuff you might see,
yeah.
You know, subverting how sort of the mainstream magazines might write about relationships. And why did you choose to do it in that way? Like what for you is important about that way?
I think it just reflects our interests. I don't think we thought like, let's do a section on music and a section on this and a section on that at the start. So we started with Letter to Male Activists. Well, actually, I think RDAP. Well, so we had a few different documents that we'd done because just for jokes, like just amongst ourselves, which is like, let's just do this stuff. So we had some stuff we could, and then we decided we should put it on a blog. So it all kind of really, really organic. We never really sat down and said, let's do a strategy, let's do a plan. It was all organic. So Angela's a hip-hop artist and spoken word artist. I grew up, I'm actually from the estate where a whole genre of music has come from called grime. And it's kind of like a mix between hip-hop and bashment and reggae and like electronic music. It's very electronic. So I'm sort of from this place. Angela's from the hip-hop, so hip-hop and grime are going to be a part of it. But also it's a class thing, right? So they're both forms of expression of the oppressed. So if we put hip-hop and grime, if we put radical feminists, people are going to think we're middle class and all our friends are white and we're these kinds of people. If we put hip-hop and grime, people automatically know, what? They listen to hip-hop and grime. We must be a certain kind of person, right? And we must have certain kind of allegiances and certain kind of life. I'm not saying that everyone that listens to hip-hop and grime is oppressed, because they're not. To get mainstream, white people, middle class people had to start buying it. But it comes from, yeah, like authentic hip-hop and grime comes from the oppressed, like, in my opinion. So that's where the music element comes in. Just through interest and through who we are. then the feminist element, and then, yeah, veganism, like you say, relationship stuff. That was, so the relationship stuff, and like, it might be like it's at home in a women's magazine, that was because we wanted to reach out to women who are not typing into Google feminist epistemology standpoint, for it, who are typing into Google, is my man cheating on me? We wanted those women, we wanted to reach those women, so i.e. not educated, like, I don't want to say not educated, not formally in the academia, women who are going through oppression, or women who are being oppressed by men in their daily lives, experiencing that oppression in their everyday lives, and looking for answers, and we're there to give them feminist answers to those questions. He doesn't respect you, leave him, you're better off without him. Like, do you know what I mean? If he's doing this, and this, you shouldn't be with him.
The way Cynthia said it in the theater is, this is a deliberate intervention. We're intervening in the process where they're not, so they're not going to get, you know, how to keep your man and make him stay with you. It's like how to leave a bad relationship, how to identify a bad relationship, and then leave it. So yeah, very, I would say that aspect of it is like, let's become a new resource for these women who are going to be confronted with a lot of non-feminist stuff on the web, basically, because the web is so
male-dominated
and aggressive and that kind of stuff. So yeah, and I think it really has become that, because I think there are lots of people who come back and visit a lot, and we get loads of hits every day for that same kind of stuff.
For cheating. What, is my man cheating on me? Or man cheat text. Is texting cheating? Facebook cheat text, whatever. We get those every day, don't we? Every single day we get those. So every single day, a woman somewhere around the planet is typing into Google, is he cheating on me with this text?
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And then they're getting us saying, yes, he probably is. If he says it's his friend, he's probably lying. Like, if you... We come from this standpoint. People might think, oh my God, they're just going to confuse me with me. No. We come from this standpoint. If you are in a relationship and you have become so desperate in that relationship that you are on Google typing, is my man cheating? Even if he isn't, he has made you feel so desperate for answers that you'll turn into the internet, because you've probably got no one else. Your girls have probably already told you to leave him and they're fed up and talking to you about it. If you're at the stage where you're upset and typing into Google about your boyfriend, leave him, because you shouldn't be at that stage, basically. He's done enough to warrant leaving him at that stage. And I don't think there's any case of like, oh, maybe the woman shouldn't leave him and he's being really good to her, but she's just pamped. No, I don't believe in any of that. Like, this is a system of oppression, this is patriarchy, and these women need to know that.
Let's be realistic.
So we focus on self-care, on like, you know, loving yourself, things like that, which sounds cliche, but we try to get across to these women, like, these men are not going to bring you happiness. Like, you are going to be happier when you leave him, right? And so just even that, like, asserting that you can be single and be happy is, in this day and age, still really big in a world that makes you feel like you're a woman, you're incomplete if you haven't got a man. Like. Yeah.
And if we encounter tips for how to make that process easier, we put those up there too. You know, if we encounter ways to make the, because we're going through those same things ourselves. So the stuff that we write about is stuff that is very experiential. We've been through it. We're going through it on a day-to-day basis. And if we run into something that's useful for the blog, we just add it. And then what you were saying about how diverse it is, and I think that's because of that process. It's like we just run into something and we formulate it into an idea or an article or a post, and then put it up there. And then afterwards, we realize that the organic process has occurred, and that things are naturally grouping, or that you can naturally group things into categories. So we have relationships, revolution, music, linguistics. Like, women we admire, common themes around which we organize, and things just when they arise, for example, Wangari Maathai, the environmental feminist, activist. When she passed away in September, we were like, let's do a Women We Admire post on her. And so we're engaging the stuff that's happening in the world and taking note of feminism as it happens around us.
So the Women We Admire section has got hip-hop artists, Erykah Badu, neo-soul artists, who are feminist and revolutionary and vegan and etc. But then it's also got Kenyan environmentalist activists and the... she's a writer.
Chinese American, Grace Lee Boggs, Chinese American activist who's almost 100 years old, and so she's been through a lot of.
And she's still going, isn't she? Giving talks.
She's on Democracy Now.
So we've got a range of women, and I think it just I think it's just inspiring for other people.
What about in the whole thing? Because you're sort of like
subverting, as you say, like the very male, aggressive, patriarchal media online. And in that media, obviously, women's bodies become objects, right? Disassociated from themselves, we're not encouraged to have self-care in any meaningful sense, but rather to be used and abused by a system and by men and by other people. So what about sexuality and sensuality? Where's that coming from?
We've got quite a lot on this. We've got Revolutionary Lover's Guide, which, as you'd imagine, is a sort of step-by-step guide to unlearning oppression, trust and establishing trust and openness and communication. And so it's about exploring sexuality in ways that aren't reinforcing any kind of oppression. So we talk about identifying whether, we acknowledge that this stuff intersects, but we're talking about identifying whether you're the kind of person who has maybe historically got some kind of privilege and that that's coming out in your relationship, or if alternatively you're the kind of person who has maybe experienced oppression and so you don't expect your needs and desires to be listened to. What are you doing? So we identify that, and it's really about building communication and exploring sexuality. So we I think we counter that by encouraging women to explore their own sexuality, giving them that confidence and letting them know they have the right, etc. Just quickly, before I let Angela speak, we also talk about, this is quite a extreme case of a female MC, so a female rapper from Birmingham in the UK, who got famous because she was rapping about having sex. She was 16 and she got famous because she was rapping about having sex with 10, 15 men at the same time. Now, if that sounds shocking to you, then you're not from the kind of area I'm from. In the kind of area I'm from, it's quite common for girls, often who have been in care or have had really unstable backgrounds, and often who have been sexually abused, so they're survivors of sexual abuse and they don't feel that their body has any value. It's very common for them to be gang raped. It's called lineups. In America, it's called running a train. Footballers do it. It's been in the papers. You might have heard footballers have been doing this. 10, 15 footballers all have sex with the same girl. I call it gang rape, they call it, lineups or whatever. So we talked about this because it's at the heart of an issue, and there was some really great stuff on Colour Lines. There's a brilliant feminist article on Colour Lines about this issue, because in America it happened with, I think, 25 men aged from like 14 to 30 who had raped this Latina girl. And it was a black woman talking about the black community's response to these kinds of issues and stuff like that. So we talk about, so we range from sort of a positive revolutionary love guide to discussing the fact that women labelled slags or sluts or whatever are being abused, that's a form of violence that affects all women. Labelling her in that way and raping her in that way is negative for all women. So that taking the upper, the so-called moral high ground, I'm not a slag, is not helping. So we really, really address that, and we say we stand in solidarity. It might seem really shocking, but we say we stand in solidarity with her and women who have had other kinds of experiences like that. Mm-hmm. We talk about rape, what it is, etc. And we end the article by saying that everybody, no matter their background, race, religion, colour, deserves to feel loved, respected and valued in their sexual relationships, and nobody should be engaging in any kind of sexual that makes coercion. Them feel that makes them feel coerced, forced, disrespected, degraded, that makes them in any way uncomfortable. That's not. So we try to encourage a healthy exploration of sexuality. We put up a female rapper called Aku Inaru's really powerful exploration of sexuality. So we try to promote women who explore sexuality positively. We try to stand in solidarity with women who've had their sexuality taken from them and who have been objectified in that way. So sexuality is a big part of it. We're not shying away from it. We don't really engage with the sex positive debates within feminism. We just do our thing and hope it gets the message across.
I think one thing that we do is we just interject or bring sex into the conversation in a way that's not shocking. Like we talk about it as a normal part of everyday life and talk about the difficulties of a feminine sexuality, as well as some of the things that we've learned about how we like to practice our feminine sexualities. Just specifically the Revolutionary Lover's Guide has a little section on sex. Most of it is about unlearning and communication and honesty and openness, but the little section on sex just says sex should be about mutual consent, desire and agency, and we're really that's what we're
learning from each other's bodies. It says be really aware of each other's, mm-hmm. like what you're expressing,
and so we're just trying to keep that the central focus and then critique things that aren't allowing those processes to occur.
How's it transformed you then, the blog?
I'm celibate. I haven't had sex in months because it works. So it's transformed me because it won't. Since the blog, I cannot allow men to treat me how they always have treated me. I just can't do it anymore because I'm like, I'm doing a blog on this. How can I let a man treat me in a way that I've written an article about? Like, I can't do this. I cannot do this. So I just don't put up with the treatment anymore, which means I'm single because there are no feminists. Well, in my circles, there are no, like...
Well, that's the problem, isn't it? Because as you, this whole thing of voice speaking out, you see it, you begin to see it everywhere.
Yeah.
You see it, and then it's like, yeah, hang on, you want to be consistent, you want to be loving yourself, you want to be caring for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So that means it really puts up problems for you being barriers, because there aren't, yeah. It's very...
So I just end up being celibate. I've got this thing called celibacy for sanity, and I basically, my argument is that I need to be away from men. Like, I just can't be engaging in those kinds of relationships and healing, you know, like, I need that space. So it's affecting me by completely, I'm essentially living a feminist separatist life now. No, I've still got loads of male friends and I still have a bit of male company, but I'm not engaging in any kind of relationship. I'm not having sex with anyone. So it's really profoundly affected me in a political way, because I feel like I'm, you know, organized, and because we've done workshops and stuff, and we don't just want to do a blog. Like, this is part of this is part of organizing, you know. And, you know, we went on that demo in London, we networked with other feminist organisations that we met there and stuff like that. So we want to build something. So it's both political and personal has affected me really quite profoundly. But yeah, definitely the personal aspect has just been, I just can't vibe with it anymore.
I the blog has been the most important writing project I feel that I've been engaged with in terms of effect. A number of people that are reading it, and maybe in terms of like lasting works. Although I've been a writer for most of my life now, I haven't formally published a whole lot of stuff. And so all of the publishing that's gone onto the blog has really, for me, cemented my engagement as a feminist writer, I would say, and that's really exciting, personally. Also, it has transformed my understanding of feminism. Like, thinking back to the question in the beginning, is like, where did your feminist ideology develop? I have to say, like, my language has come from living with Fabia. Like, the ways that I'm able to articulate the stuff that I have, the before I would just speak around that I wouldn't name, because I didn't have names for it. Soph has been able to, through our discussions, has been able to enlighten me, for lack of a better term. So I've been able to, and now that I can see what's happening in everyday life, I have names for it, I have language for it, and I can relate it to things, and now I can write about it. And this is a process. Whereas before I was writing mostly in poetry, and the difference between poetry and prose is that with poetry you don't have to give all the details. And I was good at not giving all the details because some of the stuff is really hard to write about. But now, because the blog exists and that I have models and examples for how to write about feminism, I'm able to articulate myself in prose form about things that I think. So personally, I feel like it's transformed my writing in that way. Yes, it's been an avenue for larger political organizing. I think that's amazing as well. But I also like that it's pulled up all of these new ways for us to articulate feminism. So not only do we have the blog itself, but we also have 3 Twitters. One Twitter that's from Sister Resista, that's basically just anything that has to do with feminism versus patriarchy. We have another that's a list of feminism tips. So, like I said, when something comes up that is a useful way for us to address things that we're experiencing, we put that up there. And then thirdly, we have a satirical Twitter from patriarchy, and it says things like, I am patriarchy and I wish to make you submit to me, blah, 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 blah. And so...
It's better than that.
It's much better than that.
I want your willing submission.
it's
very good.
So I think that...
It's got like 500 followers.
Yeah, and that was quickly as well. Okay. So I think that the existence of the blog has brought up other ways for us to start describing and naming and healing.
I need to come back on some things. Angela's made it sound like her poetry writes around feminist issues, and that's not true at all. Listening to Angela. So Angela recently did a set, like an hour set at the Sumac Centre, which is a social centre on a night full of female only artists, and her spoken word about, be it Whitney Houston, obviously her famously abusive relationship, be it about falling in love with men who are a bit rough and a bit gangster and how that makes us feel and how we work through that. I think that came as a result of us talking, us both on that. So what I'm trying to say is that I'm not disagreeing with what Angela said about developing prose as opposed to poetry, but her poetry is actually, as a feminist, very therapeutic to listen to. If you're a woman in the audience, hearing your experiences expressed in that way, as opposed to prose, is powerful in a different way. So don't let her be modest to make it sound like she was writing around anything. She doesn't write around anything, she writes through it. Like, and the poetry, and it's performance poetry, and it's really, really powerful. And it's a spiritual experience as a woman to go, if you're a feminist, to go and listen to Angela talk about the things that she talks about. And the other thing that she reminded me when she was talking is that if she hadn't moved in and we hadn't been working on this blog, I would definitely still be in like a really abusive relationship. So I was with someone. Was that even when I first got to know you? No, because we met him on my birthday. Yeah, early on in our friendship, I got into an abusive relationship. I didn't know it was abusive because, as someone, I'm a survivor of childhood abuse, like really severe, prolonged childhood abuse. And so I confuse abuse and love. So when I was supposed to receive love as a child, I received abuse. So now when I get abuse, I think it's love. So I fall in love with people who abuse me, is what I'm saying. And so I loved him, like, he was so abusive, I absolutely loved him, I wanted his children, I was head over heels, I loved this guy. And it was Angela, and then Angela moved in, and I think I split out with him before he moved in, but I would still be seeing him. Basically she moved in and we would talk about him and stuff. And I just remember her being like, you know, what he's done there, I don't know, tell the details, but what he done, she said, that's textbook abuse, like what he's doing is abusive. Like, and it never occurred to me that this guy that I love so much was in any way abusive, you know? And so it was only through like having those discussions that I was like, okay, this isn't good for me, like I need to stop seeing him. But no, I would definitely still be in an abusive relationship if it wasn't for Angela moving in. Like, in fact, he probably would. He was going to move in. He'd probably been moving in. And I would just be with...
I was really thinking guys who wouldn't be worth it.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I stopped completely as well.
Being in friendship is feminist resistance.
Right? Yeah, and it's just stopped us. It literally stopped us getting with men who are abusive, literally on that level. I don't get with abusive men anymore.
Users, yeah. No more users.
We just won't
prioritize ourselves, yeah.
It's wonderful. I love that. I mean, I'm very into feminist spirituality, right? Mm-hmm. I love the spiritual idea. But I don't know, would you feel like we're saying one of your poems or something to close? Because an energy, if you've got you, I didn't
while,
even
while you think, while you think one through, through yeah. While she gets one, I'll just reflect on the spirituality thing. Because yeah. Both me and Angela... So I come to it recently, I lost my mum recently, and that, you know, you go to it through need, I think people that aren't spiritual people have never had that need to develop that side of themselves. So they go along, maybe they're scientists or atheists or socialists, whatever, okay, fine. They go along with those kinds of beliefs and they don't need to draw on anything else, and that's fine. But when you really need to develop what it means to be spiritual and stuff, when you're faced with that need, then you go to something like yoga. So I'd always done yoga, but when I went to yoga really needing to develop this spiritual strength and stuff like that, then this whole other realm comes in. So both me and Angela practice yoga regularly. We go to workshops and classes and we practice at home. And so we believe in meditation, and we believe in practicing meditation for relaxation or whatever, but also for spiritual to firm up our souls, you know, like to ground our souls and to remind us to be mindful, to be aware, and to remind us that we are, you know, yoga means unity or oneness, and it's about uniting the individual consciousness with a global consciousness. So to remind us that we are one, you know, like, because I think the system tries to make us think of ourselves as individuals, and we've as human beings, we've separated ourselves from the nature and the world, and it's easy to get caught up in a 9-to-5 and forget that it's one planet and, you know, that we're in a solar system. And so, yeah, no, we're very, for people who don't know about spirituality, it's so hard to put into words, it's like how you feel hard, when you do it? A yoga. I went to a yoga workshop, being a complete atheist and da-da-da. I went to a yoga workshop, we did some meditation, we did some chanting, and the strength that I had inside of me and the calmness, I can only explain it in spiritual terms because these are emotional things, like, and it just firmed me up when I most needed it. So I found spirituality when I most needed it, and it got me through some really hard times and is now a part of my life, you know. And not in a sort of like imaginary God in the sky judging me from a cloud kind of way,
nope.
But just in a sort of, you know, this is the way I always explain it, not in an imaginary God kind of way, in a sort of energy oneness kind of way. Like, if you don't know what that means, then I'm
power
sorry.
With it and power together, because I think feminist spirituality, unlike patriarchal organized religion, is not about power over and hierarchies. It's about circles power and connections, power within us. We all have that oneness within us and connection. That's a beautiful one to explore, actually. We should do more stuff on that.
Let's do that one.
Is that the one
you're thinking of doing?
Yeah.
It's about yoga.
Beautiful.
Harvesting the body. There comes a time when we must harvest who we are and what we have done here. Whether we listened, learned, laughed, loved, whether we brought joy into the world. The universe resonates with the vibrations we emit. The planet's face, a reflection of our own. What do we bring? And what do we bring forth? In yoga, we are told to breathe into a stretch, that the points of most pain are the times for greatest growth. You can tell you are improving when your grimace slowly transforms into a grin without much thinking. You feel yourself pushing past what you thought was the end point, the maximum, like when you couldn't take any more and your body suddenly gives and you become offering, become bounty, and your boundaries are no more. Like the earth, our bodies know the harvest. Breathe into the stretch.
Beautiful. Thank you. Thank you guys for the time.
Thank you
for sharing that time. Beautiful.
Appreciate it. Thank you for the interview. Thank you for organizing the interview.
Thank you.
Please.
Sure.